Morning. I imagine some of you probably wondered where we've been for the last few weeks. We, between Farm Show and Berryville Steam Engine Show and the beach, we've been away. We managed to survive the beach after watching Shark Week prior to going. I was not the most excited person to be there, and my boys get kind of frustrated with me because the whole time that we're in the water, I'm constantly watching and saying, don't go too far, stay back, you know, make sure there are a lot of people in front of you so that there's a nice menu of people out there. Anytime the people start moving out, I come back in, you know, and try to make sure that there's a big smorgasbord of people there. But we had a great time. God bless us with beautiful weather, and we had one lightning storm on one of the evenings, which was absolutely beautiful, just watching the lightning and the thunder, and so it was a great time. But our thoughts were here with you. I was praying for you as your services were in action, and I trust you had a time of worship. Well, before we begin reading this section, I want to talk about some basic things. Some 43 years, or rather 20 years, had passed between the events in chapters 4 and 5. And after ruling for 43 years, Nebuchadnezzar's gone. He's been gone for a few years now. And there was a series of people who succeeded him. And then he was finally succeeded by his grandson, Belshazzar. And unlike Nebuchadnezzar, the reigns of all of his predecessors, or all of his succeeders, rather, there was an increasing cultural and military weakness. So after Nebuchadnezzar left the scene, the economy, the culture, and the military continued to weaken. And part of that was due to the fact that the culture became very focused on things like pleasure and just having a good time. And as that happened, as it always happens, everything began to fall apart. And by October of 539, the whole Babylonian kingdom was reduced to one city, and that was the city of Babylon itself. So everything was gone. This mighty kingdom that at one time had included all of that area, all of the Middle East, all of what's Iraq and going down into the Arabian Peninsula, down into Egypt, and all the way to the Mediterranean and up into the Turkey area, all of that was now gone. And the only thing they had was the mighty city of Babylon, and they felt secure. So as the story unfolds in chapter 5, you have to understand that Cyrus at that point, the Persian commander, surrounded the city, had the city surrounded, was on the point of taking the city. And there was one thing about that city. It was totally secure in that no one could get in. The walls were so thick. They were so high. The city was so powerful. It was impossible to get into the city. But it had a weakness. And it was a weakness that they didn't really think about. And that was as a river ran through the center of the city called the Euphrates. And as this river ran through the city, they protected the city by having a series of iron bars down in the water, under the wall, and the bars served as a protection. They also blocked trash and limbs and logs and things from flowing into the city. So it was a sort of protection, but it was also there so that no one could swim under the wall in the river and get into the city. But there was a problem with that, and that was that those bars didn't go all the way to the bottom. They only went part way down. And so in order to take the city, what Cyrus did is several miles upstream, he simply dammed the river. He dug a canal and diverted the river into a swamp, and they were then able to lower the level of the water during the night and slip into the city under the sluice gates. It was an amazing plan, an amazing feat of engineering, and it was done so quickly that the people were totally unaware that it was even happening. And once they entered the city, they simply went up to the gates, unlocked them, opened the gates, and the army marched in. It was a great plan. It was one of the best military plans that has ever been used to take a city. It was a great plan. And Cyrus was one of the most successful Persian leaders because of that. And he was showered with a lot of praise because of his ability to do that. All of this seemed to totally escape the notice of Belshazzar and everyone in the city. And that's the amazing thing, because there are a lot of parallels between what is going on here in this city, in this story, and what's happening in our country. And that is the seeming inability of our leaders to realize that our city, our country, is being invaded and is being slowly taken over. And so as we read through this, I want you to give thought to the parallels between the story and our own country. And I want you to think about your responsibility and my responsibility as citizens of this country, as patriots, and what our responsibility is to God and also to the security of our nation. So look with me there in Daniel 5, and we're going to start off on reading verses 1 through 4, and we're going to do this in chunks rather than reading the whole thing. My plan is to go through it, but we're not going to rush. And please don't send me a text. I don't have my phone. So follow along with me there, 5, 1 through 4. So King Belshazzar held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. Now think about it. The armies of the Persians are all the way around the city. The city is completely surrounded by these people. And here Belshazzar's having a party. So he's holding this great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he drinks wine in their presence. Now, drinking wine in the presence of your nobles was unheard of in this culture. They just didn't do that. As a matter of fact, in Proverbs 31, Solomon, the writer there of that proverb, or rather of that section of Proverbs, tells us kings should not do this. Kings should not spend their time drinking wine in front of other people. And there's a reason for that. It's because their judgment becomes impaired. And so what he's telling us is, don't do that. Don't allow your judgment, if you're in a position of leadership, to become impaired. And that's why it's so important for the leaders of a church especially, or of a nation, of any government body, to make sure that they have a clear mind at all times so that they'll make rational and good decisions. So here he is drinking this wine in their presence. And under the influence of the wine, Belshazzar gave orders to bring in the gold and silver vessels that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines could drink from them. And so they brought in the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised their gods, made of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. All right, so this feast is a microcosm of the Babylonian system. In fact, the banquet itself was designed to show contempt for the armies of the Medes and Persians. What Belshazzar was trying to do was to encourage his people. He was trying to show them that, hey, I'm not concerned. I'm not concerned by the fact that we have an army surrounding us. I'm not concerned by the fact that the water level in the river is going down. I'm just going to hold a big party and we're all going to have fun. Let's eat and drink and be merry. And not only is he showing contempt for these people, but then he goes to the point where he begins to show contempt for the power of the true God when he orders these gold and silver articles to be brought before him. Now, I want you to think about something. When Nebuchadnezzar took these articles from the temple and burnt the temple, he never took them and defiled them. Never at any point did Nebuchadnezzar take these goblets, these vessels, these bowls, and these dishes and use them in a profane way, even though he had complete control of the God of the Jews in his mind. Even though he destroyed the temple, he honored these vessels and did not dishonor them. And as the wine is passing from the hand to hand of the men and women, and they're blaspheming in the name of God, All of a sudden, something begins to happen. Look at verses 5 through 9. So here they are. They're drinking. They're praising these gods of silver and gold and iron, bronze, and wood. And they're doing this, and they're enjoying themselves. And all of a sudden, a hand appears. Look at the verse there. Look at verse 5. At that moment, the fingers of a man's hand appeared. And he began writing on the plaster of the king's palace wall next to the lampstand. A few years ago, they excavated this palace, and they found that the walls on the inside, this banquet hall, are white, plastered white. I used to do quite a bit of plaster work, and this kind of plaster in particular was my favorite to do. And when you plaster a wall like that, it shines. There's something about lime plaster. When you actually plaster the wall, it glistens and reflects light. And so everything that's written on that wall shows up. And so as they're sitting here, they're looking at this wall, and this hand begins to appear and begins to write on it, and there's a reflection that's occurring. And look at what happens here as he's writing here, as the Lord begins to write. Over against the lampstand, the king is watching the hand that was writing, and his face turns pale, and his thoughts begin to become so terrified in him that his hip joints shake and his knees begin to knock together. And the king called out to bring in the mediums and the Chaldeans and the astrologers, and he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this inscription and gives me its interpretation will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain around his neck, and have the third highest position in the kingdom." Now, he could do this. The reason he could give the third highest position in the kingdom is because he was not actual king. His father was king, but his father was one who would go out on these spiritual quests to the various gods of Babylon. And so he would stay gone for extended periods of time. And so in his place, he would leave his son, Belshazzar, in charge as co-regent. And so when he's saying here, "I'm going to give you the third position, if you can interpret this," he's actually speaking as under me, under the king. And the interesting thing, as I read this, I thought to myself, who gives him the authority to do this? He certainly hasn't spoken to his father. His father is a very spiritual man, but he's left in charge this man who's prone to drunkenness. And he's left him in charge to make these kinds of decisions. And I thought to myself, he really doesn't have the authority to do this. And yet he promises something, and he intends to follow through with it. Now, for years, when scholars would look at this, and historians and archaeologists, they said there was never a person named Belshazzar in the kingdom of Babylon. And then guess what they found? They found a stele, which was written in cuneiform from that period of time, talking about Belshazzar and all of his exploits. That was several years ago. So Belshazzar was shown to be who he was. So they come in, and all the king's wise men come in, but none could read the inscription, follow along with me there, or make known its interpretation. And then King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face turned pale, and his nobles were totally bewildered. So as the king and his company is raising these cups to their lips, and they're praising these gods, by one of the lamps, a hand appears to pass judgment. And if you think about what it was like to be in a banquet hall at that time, it's nighttime, it's dark in the hall. It's not like this. They didn't have electric lights, so the place would not be lit like this. So you have a long hallway, and as in that hallway, it would be dark, but there would be areas, patches of light. There would be recesses set into the wall, and in those recesses would be oil lamps. And the oil lamps would flicker, and they would smoke, and they would cast shadows. And if you think about it for just a moment, it would be very eerie to be in a place like that. And when they saw this hand, think about what that would look like. Here you are in this. If you've ever been in a movie theater, a story is told about a man who had never been to the movie theater before. And he was given money to go, and he went into the movie theater, and it was already dark because he arrived late. And when he came in, he looked, and he saw only beams of light coming at him. And he's looking and he's thinking, why would I pay money to see beams of light? And one of the people came up to him and said, "Can I help you?" He said, "I see nothing but beams of light." He said, "Turn around." And he turned around and he went, "Ah!" Because he had never seen a face before. And here are these faces on the screen. But think about what it was like to be in this banquet hall. It's dark. It's smoky. Everyone's drunk. And all of a sudden, in the eerie light by one of the lamps, you begin to see a hand beginning to write. You can imagine what that must have made them feel like. I would have been terrified. And so here this hand begins to write. And as it begins to write, they become more and more and more frightened. Notice in verse 6 how the king reacts. He becomes totally terrified and he loses all control. His hips begin to shake and his knees begin to tremble. In Proverbs 28:1, the Bible tells us the wicked flee, though no one pursues, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. So this man has nothing to stand on. He's totally fearful. But notice in verse 7 how he reacts. He follows the same pattern that we so often follow when our lives are falling apart. We go to people who are just as messed up as we are to try to find the answer. Think about what we do. As soon as we have an issue, what do? We go on Facebook, right? And we begin to share our issues with the world so that everyone can see them. And everyone in the world who's as messed up as we are begins to give us advice and tell us what to do. And so Belshazzar basically has gone to Facebook by calling these people in, and he looks at them and he says, "Tell me what this means." But they're as confused as he is. Listen to what it says there. "So all the king's wise men came in, but none could read the inscription or make known its interpretation." And then notice again in verse 9:10 what happens. He begins to cry out. And not only does he begin to cry out, but the whole attitude of the room begins to follow his lead. And all of the elders and all of the people in the room, all of the nobles and all of the wives and everyone else, they begin to cry out. And they can't grasp the meaning of the spiritual message that's been shared with them. And each night, listen to this for just a moment. Each night, when I'm watching the news, I see modern Belshazzars doing the same thing. And each of them are crying out in amazement because they have no ability to understand the spiritual issues that our world is struggling with. And I watch them going to the same so-called stupid experts, these Chaldeans who come to them and tell them what they need to do. And as I listen to these people, they sit across from these reporters, and when they're asked what needs to be done, for instance, to stop Islamic terrorism, they're unable to provide a good answer. Some of them have actually begun to tell us that these things are due to education. They're stupid people. They don't have an education. What they need is they need to be taught. Then others come along and they say, what it need is they need a job. Give them a job. Go over there and give them a job and they'll stop this. Now they're beginning to tell us it's being caused by global warming. As silly as that sounds, they're telling us now that it's being caused by global warming. If that area of the world was not hot, these people would not do this. They're doing it because if you've ever looked at the map, you realize that they live in an area where it's very hot, right? It's a desert, and in deserts, it's generally very hot, and that's not caused by global warming. But you see, their eyes and minds are totally blinded to the truth, and just as the Chaldeans in Daniel's time, they're unable to read the writing on the wall, and they're unable to define the times in which we live. During one of the recent political conventions, one of the speakers said that what our country needs is for everyone just to love one another and accept one another. And yet that very person in that very political party totally rejects the Prince of Peace, the one who can give them that kind of love. They want to seek it elsewhere, just as Belshazzar did. You see, just like Belshazzar, the rulers of our nation, they will try every solution, but they will have no better success than he did in solving the problems that we face. Look with me there in verses 10 through 29, and let's look at discovering the future of this king and this kingdom. Because of the outcry of the king and his nobles, the queen came to the banquet hall, and she says this, "May the king live forever. Don't let your thoughts terrify you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the days of your predecessor, he was found to have insight, intelligence, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods. Your predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the diviners, the mediums, the Chaldeans, and astrologers. Your own predecessor, the king, did this because Daniel, the one the king named Belshazzar, was found to have an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and perception and the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems. Therefore, summon Daniel, and he will give the interpretation. Then Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the Judean exiles that my predecessor the king brought from Judah?" And we'll stop there. So as the king and his nobles are trembling in fear, this wise grandmother queen enters the banquet hall. A lot of scholars believe she was the wife of Nebuchadnezzar. I particularly think she may have been the Persian wife, the one that he built the hanging gardens for. And this lady comes in, this aged, wise lady comes in. And she looks at her grandson, and I can imagine she probably looks at him in disbelief, because here, gathered around him, are all these people. And all of these cups are lying around, bowls of wine. And she probably looks at him in disgust, knowing that he never measured up to what her husband was. And so she looks at him, and while she's talking to him, she wastes no time but cuts to the chase. The first thing that she does is she reminds him of something that he really should already know, and that is there is a man in his kingdom, a wise man. And for Belshazzar to be unaware of this is totally inexcusable, because you see, what he's done is he spent his life, his kingdom, his power pursuing sex and pursuing wine and pursuing pleasure, all the things that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar did not do. So look at the verses there. Notice particularly in verses 11 through 12 that she refers to Daniel by his Hebrew name. When I was looking at that, I thought this is very interesting, because I believe it speaks to an intimate understanding and knowledge of Daniel as a person. And it belies the great respect that she has for him, the fact that she calls him Daniel. And as she speaks, she states that Daniel is a man with a reputation. The first thing that she tells him is he has an extraordinary spirit. She refers to him as a man with the holy gods. You remember Nebuchadnezzar would often say of him, "You have the spirit of the holy gods in you." And then she goes on and she says he has knowledge. And then she says he has perception and he has ability to interpret dreams. And curiously, throughout his reign, Belshazzar had completely ignored all of this. As a matter of fact, when we get to chapter 7, you'll see that during the time of the reign of Belshazzar, Daniel has some of his most important dreams in chapter 7 and chapter 8. In 1905, George Santana said this, "They who forget the past are doomed to repeat it." Think about that for just a moment. They who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And if you think about it for just a moment, those who ignore the wisdom and lessons of the past are going to repeat the mistakes of the past. Listen to me, young people. If you ignore the wisdom of your parents, you will be doomed to repeat the mistakes that they have made. You see, all of us, when we show this gray hair, or we show no hair, or we show whatever we show, we show that because we have done the stupid things that you are about to do. And we know. And when we tell you not to do something, we speak from years of wisdom and years of mistakes. Someone once said, "Don't learn from your own mistakes, learn from the mistakes of others." Listen. And people my age would be wise to listen to people who are much older than I am. Because people older than me have more experience than me. They've made more mistakes. So it's wise for me to listen. So listen to those from the past. And no time in history more than today would it be important for our leaders to quit ignoring the lessons of the past. And their abandoning of the past speaks of sheer recklessness. I look at them and I think, where did you come from? Who taught you this? How in a nation like our nation can you even think that that is the right thing to do? Where did you come from? Because it's not the nation that I knew as a child growing up. It's not the kind of things that I was taught. So I'm wondering who has taught these people. G.K. Chesterton wrote this. In 1929, he said, "In the matter of reforming things, there is one plain and simple principle, a principle which will probably be called a paradox. There exists in such a case a certain institution of law, let us say, for the sake of simplicity, a fence or gate across a road. And he says, the more modern type of reformer, like the people we have today, will go gaily up to it and say, I don't see the need of this. Let's get it out of the way. Let's clear it out of the way. To which the more intelligent type of reformer will do well to answer, if you don't see the use of it, if you don't have enough understanding to understand why it is there, I will not let you clear it away. Go away and think. And then when you can come back and tell me that you do see the use of it and the importance of it, I may allow you to destroy it. At another time, he wrote this. He said, don't ever take down a fence until you know the reason it was put up. In other words, when you see a boundary, when you see a rule, when you see a law, first ask, why is it there? When there are rules against sexual immorality, why is it there? Why does God put such rules in place if there's not a reason? When God says that you should work to earn your bread, why does he say that? Because of the devastating effect that it has upon the person and the psyche of the person when they become dependent upon other people or dependent upon the government. That's why God has these particular rules in place. So the first thing our leaders should ask, why is it there? Rather than beginning to tear things down as if they're an elephant in a china shop. And you see, despite all of this logic, our leaders are going about abandoning what they don't understand. They seek what they do not know in hopes of one day understanding it all. Think about that for just a minute. Our leaders are abandoning what they don't understand. They go about seeking what they don't even know and don't begin to understand in hopes of one day being able to understand it. And oftentimes we do the same and we fall lockstep in place with them. Many in the church and oftentimes me become confused by all of the rhetoric and all of the information, and we begin to slide and we begin to think the way they do. And it's because the message of the world is beginning to creep in and beginning to seep in as we become influenced by it. You see, these people, they conduct social experience with alternative lifestyles that have never succeeded in the history of man while deliberately tearing apart the very fabric upon which we are built. Think about it for just a minute. What God calls sin, they call freedom of choice. What God calls an abomination, they call an alternative lifestyle. What God calls murder, they call choice. Think about it for just a minute. In Romans 1:18-32, the Bible tells us, Paul's telling the Romans, he says, they do this deliberately. They tear everything down and they turn their faces away from God because they do not desire to know him. It has absolutely nothing to do with new revelation. It's the same old desire to turn away from God and do as they please. But look what happens here as the king begins to address Daniel in verses 13 through 16. Listen to the words he uses, and I want you to get the feeling for what he's doing here. Daniel was brought before the king, and the king says to him, now think about it for just a moment. Here's Daniel, and he comes into this banquet hall. And he's standing before this man that he has absolutely no respect for. And listen to what happens here. So the king says to him, are you Daniel, one of the Judean exiles that my predecessor, the king, brought from Judah? He should know this. He should know who he is. Here he is, the king of a nation. He is the wisest man in the kingdom, and he doesn't even know who he is. Sometimes I look at our leaders in our country and I think to myself, do they have anyone wise at all in their kingdom? Sometimes I look at some of the people that our leaders are surrounding themselves with. And I think back to Solomon's time or Solomon's son's time when Solomon died and his son surrounded him with people just like himself, young people who didn't know anything. And he went to them and he asked them for guidance. Tell me what to do. And he went to the old people first, and he said, tell me what to do. And then he went to those of his own generation, and they told him the same foolishness that was in his heart, and he lost the kingdom. So look at what happens here. Look at what he says. He says, I've heard that you have the spirit of the gods in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and extraordinary wisdom. And now the wise men and mediums were brought before me to read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not give its interpretation. However, I have heard about you that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Therefore, if you can read this inscription and give me its interpretation, you will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain around your neck, and have the third highest position in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered the king. Listen to what he says here. Keep your gifts. Keep it and give it to somebody else. All right, let's take a look at that for just a moment. Notice the words the king uses to address Daniel. First, he addresses him as a captive. Are you Daniel, one of the Judean exiles? Now, I want you to think about this for just a minute. Here's a man who's totally out of control, who has no understanding of what's going on. His knees are shaking, his hips are shaking, and yet he looks at the one who has the answer. He's just been told this guy has the answer. And he looks at him and he reminds him of who he is. You're just a slave. You're just a captive. So he talks to him in this way. He's just defiled Daniel's God, and then he reminds him that he's a captive. And if you think about it for just a moment, if you look at that whole address, you realize very quickly that this man lacks tact. He has absolutely no tact. I mean, why would you do that? Why would you go to somebody who has the answer for you and tell him, well, guess what? You're just nothing but a peon. You're a nobody, but yet you're going to tell me the answer. So get busy and let's get it on. And that's the whole attitude through the whole address. You see, not only is he brash, but he's insulting. And no shame is attached to the fact that he's talking to this Judean exile while the holy articles of the temple are lying about him. While these holy articles are lying on the floor in the sight of this Daniel. When Daniel walked in, he must have looked around and must have been disgusted, thinking to himself, these are the holy articles of my God, of my temple. And here they are on the floor with wine and other things sloshed about all over them, touching these lips of these pagans who are blaspheming the name of my God. Think about it for just a minute, what that must have been like to this man. Daniel, by this time, is around 84 years old. It must have broken his heart to see this happen. And then notice in verse 16 that the king hopes it may be a bribe. I'll just give him a bribe. I'll encourage him to do this. And as he looked about the drunken crowd, Daniel totally refused to take these gifts. Look at verse 17. You keep them. Give them to someone else. I don't want them. And if you think about it, there's a twofold message in that. Daniel knows that the kingdom's going to fall that night. God's revealing that to him as he's looking at the message before he even begins to speak. And he's probably thinking, why do I want that? He wouldn't have taken it anyway. But he's looking at the king and he says, you're nuts. You're totally crazy. Why would you offer something to me that you're getting ready to lose? Look at the verses there. I want you to imagine for a moment the contrast between these two. Daniel is old and white-haired, and this king is standing there barely able to stand. His knees are shaking, his hips are shaking, and added to that, he's drunk. And if you've ever been around people who have had too much to drink, it's an embarrassing sight. If you've ever had to have a conversation with someone in this shape, it's an embarrassing thing to do. And here's Daniel trying to reason with this man. And before Daniel satisfies his curiosity, I want you to think about something. The first thing that he does is he recounts Nebuchadnezzar's reign and the failures. And then he begins to contrast those with the failures of Belshazzar. Notice his words in verse 18, and follow along with me there as I read. He says, Your Majesty, the Most High God, gave sovereign greatness and glory and majesty to your predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar. He never looks at him and says, He gave it to you. He gave it to Nebuchadnezzar. Let's follow there with me. Because of the greatness he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages were terrified and fearful of him. And he killed anyone he wanted, and he kept alive anyone he wanted. He exalted anyone he wanted, and he humbled anyone he wanted. But when his heart was exalted and his spirit became arrogant, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken from him. And he was driven away from people. His mind was like an animal's. He lived with the wild donkeys. He was fed like grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with dew from the sky until he acknowledged that the Most High God is the ruler over the kingdom of men and sets anyone he wants over it. But you, listen to what he says, but you, his successor, but you. Look at the words he uses. Have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. Instead, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels from his house were brought to you. And as you and your nobles, wives, and concubines drink wine from them, you praise the gods made of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or understand. But you have not glorified the God. Now listen to this. In whose hand is your breath? Think about it for just a moment. In whose hand is your breath? Sometimes when I look at people and I listen to them, it breaks my heart. The profanity that flows. And the way they'll take the name of Christ and use it as a curse word, as a byword. This one who holds their breath in his hand and who died for them. And yet they'll use his name as if it is nothing. Think about what's going on here. Look at it. And you've praised these. You have not given glory to the God who holds your life breath in his hand and who controls the whole course of your life. Therefore, he sent the hand. This writing was inscribed. So look at what he says there to him. The Most High God gave you. Look at the verse there. But he reverts back to the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar, and he looks at him and he says, he gave him sovereignty and greatness and glory and majesty and world dominion. And then in verse 20, he recounts the rebuke that Nebuchadnezzar received. And if you can imagine for just a moment, Belshazzar probably began to tremble at this point because he thought, that's what's getting ready to happen to me. That's what God's getting ready to do to me. He's going to take me now and put me in that situation where I'm going to walk around like an ox and eat grass. And then Daniel gives him the clincher. And he looks at him and he says this. He levels the charges. But you, his successor, have not humbled your heart. And he says, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. It's bad enough that you didn't humble yourself. But now you also exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. In other words, you've done things Nebuchadnezzar would never have dreamed of doing. You've made yourself a stench in God's nostrils. Now think about it. Think about it for just a moment. Every day I look at our country and I'm thinking to myself, our country is making itself a stench in God's nostrils. And as hard a thing as it is to say that God will judge our country for the fact that we have not only turned from him, but we've turned all the way against him. Several years ago, 4 years ago, when the Democratic Party was holding their convention, they voted God off their platform. They did not want God in their platform. And the leaders of the party, realizing the stupidity of what they were doing, overrode the ruling and kept God in the platform, even though the people protested and screamed at them to take him out. And if you think about our country today, these are the things that are happening. Notice specifically in verse 23 the defilement with which Belshazzar surrounded himself. The first one was drunkenness, total depravity, total dependence on mind-altering drugs. The second one was sexual immorality, and the third one was lewdness. And if you think about that, it's the scene of what we see every day today in our country. This overabundance of focus on sex. And sex is used not only as an item of commerce, but drunkenness exalted and sexual immorality is encouraged and even celebrated. And not only are they becoming so saturated themselves, they've decided that the church needs this too. And so they're trying to take this deviancy, this sexual deviancy, and foist this corruption onto the church so that we also have to recognize what they are and what they think and what they practice. Because we are the light, you see. We are the mirror that's standing in front of them. And when they look at that mirror, they see themselves for what they are. They don't like it. And so they want to get rid of the mirror. And they want to crack it. And if you think about the society in which we live today, that's what's going on. And it's time for Christians to continue to stand tall and stand up and not allow that to happen. Because Christ didn't call us to comfort. Christ called us to be salt and light. Take a look at the interpretation. Let's finish it up. Verse 25 through 28. So he looks at him and he begins to read this inscription. And this is what he reads. Listen to what it says. This is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. And he goes on. He says, this is the interpretation of the message. Mene means that God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Twofold, mene, mene. He has numbered it and he has brought it to an end. Tekel means that you have been weighed in the balance and found deficient. Peres means that your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And then Belshazzar gave an order and they clothed Daniel in purple, placed a gold chain around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And that very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Notice the words that he wrote. Look at the words. You see, these words, mene, tekel, and parson, are words that are used in commerce. These are the words that the merchants would use. They would chant these words as they bargained and sold their goods. And in verse 26, Daniel begins to interpret this. And the first thing that he does is he tells them, your kingdom is numbered and is then at an end. This is the end of your reign, Belshazzar. And if you think about it, Belshazzar's looking at him in the delirium of his drunken state. He's looking at him and he's trying to comprehend what he's telling him. He's saying, it's coming to an end, buddy. It's about over. And then he goes on and he says one more thing. And he says to him in verse 27, that in addition to it being numbered, in addition to your empire coming to an end, you yourself have been weighed in God's balance scale and you've been found deficient. And the word he uses, look at the word that he uses. This is very interesting. He uses a word that means 2/5 of an ounce. A very, very, very small weight. And if you think about that, what he's doing is he's saying, God has weighed the most insignificant action on your part, and every single one of them has been found deficient. Not even the smallest act that you've committed has been something that's worthy of praise. Everything is deficient, even the smallest act. If you recall, Jesus in Matthew 12:36 told this to his disciples. He warned them and he said, I tell you, you must give an account on judgment day of every idle word which you speak. And if you think about that for just a moment, when God looks at us, when we stand before him, he's going to weigh our words. He's going to look at us and he's going to say, look at the idle words that you have spoken. Look at the way you've handled words. And you see, God is not only concerned with our actions, he's concerned with our thoughts, but he's concerned about our words. And he will weigh those things. We will have to give an account for even the most idle word that we've spoken. You see, God has an infinite idea of what justice is, and he's going to make sure that we give an account. And then notice in verse 28, the final commentary that Belshazzar is given. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. You see, this word parson means to break in two and divide. It also can be translated as Persian. And so here he's telling him, God has taken your kingdom. He's numbered it. He has weighed you. And everything is now divided. It's going to be destroyed. Listen to the words of Job 20, verse 4 through 7. Do you not know this of old, since man was placed on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? Though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens, and his hand reaches to the clouds, or his head reaches to the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuge. You see, even as these words are echoing, people are looking at this king, and they're saying to him, you're an idiot. You're insane. Because he looks at him, instead of falling to the floor, as Nebuchadnezzar would have done, he looks at him and he says, bring the robe, bring the chain, bring the scepter. And he clothes him. And I can imagine Daniel and his nobles probably looked at Belshazzar and said, "What's wrong with you? Don't you realize that in just a few hours you're going to be dead and the kingdom is going to fall, and yet you're worried about giving him a chain? Don't you think that there's something more important than that?" They probably heard the running feet outside the hall. They probably heard the screams of the people as the Persians were moving into the city, because all of that was going on while this was happening. And they're probably looking at him and saying, "You have lost it." And sometimes I look at our leaders and I think to myself, what is wrong with you people? Don't you get it? Don't you listen to yourselves? And yet in the same way, just as Belshazzar, they ignore the warning signs, the spiritual and cultural decay that's all around us. And sometimes I think that we as Christians also are totally oblivious. As long as we have our 504s or our 501s or whatever they call these things, as long as we have our bank account, as long as we have our insurance, as long as we have security, we're happy to continue as we are. Listen to me. This is not a joke. And sometimes I feel as if we as believers are so caught up in what's going to be good for us that we forget that the whole thing is about ready to implode on itself if something doesn't change. And I'm telling you, if nothing else changes, we need to get on our knees and we need to implore the God of heaven to save this nation, if only for one reason, and that is to spread his word and to save his people alive. Because I'll tell you, if things don't change, it will all implode. And if you think for just a moment that we're just going to go on with our merry lives and come here and attend this place and just have a good time, I've got another message for you. That's not the case. So it's time for Christians to wake up and begin to take seriously not only the lives that they're living, because God is weighing us in the balance and he's looking at us and he's saying to us, what about you? Are you living a life of corruption? Are you living a life of righteousness? Am I weighing you? And can I look at you and honor you? Or are you like Belshazzar, a man who's simply worried about his pleasure and having a good time? Think about it for just a moment. I want you to think about, are we heeding the warning sign that God is giving us? And are we doing something about it? This may be the very last time. You know, I hear people all the time saying, I'm not getting involved. I'm staying out of it. I'm staying home. This is not a time for Christians to stay home and stay out of it. This is a time for Christians to get up and get busy and do something about it. Because I can assure you, if we don't, they will. So listen to me. Let's all stand. Our Father, we look to you. And we stand broken before you. And we ask that you would stir the church. Not for our glory. Oh God, we have been such a disappointment and a failure to you. Not this church necessarily, but the church corporately across this nation. And I pray that you would challenge the church. Challenge this church. Challenge me. I challenge all of us to get serious about our walk with you in our homes, in our jobs, in our daily conversation, as we consider the fact that you weigh even the most idle of words, the most idle of thoughts, that all of it comes up before you. Nothing is hidden from your sight. Help us to remember that you are writing on our wall What is the message that you have for us? What is the message that you're writing about us? Are you weighing us? Are you finding us wanting? Are you finding us faithful? As your word says, blessed is he who is faithful to the end. Help us to truly be faithful. Build this church. Build your church. Stir up your church. In Jesus' name, amen.